The Berlin Security Beat is an original podcast produced by the Center for National Security at the Hertie School in Berlin. Welcome to the Berlin Security Beat, Season 3 on all things cybersecurity. In today's episode, we will discuss the cyber element of the Russian invasion of Ukraine with Professor Nadia Kostyuk, one of the world's leading experts on cyber conflict. Professor Kostyuk's research focuses on security studies, modern warfare, cyber conflict, cyber institutions and capability, as well as Russian and Eurasian politics. In today's episode, we'll discuss a range of questions regarding the conflict in Ukraine, focusing on what the conflict teaches us about cyber warfare and the evolution of the cyber domain in general. So let's jump straight in. Nadia Kostyuk, welcome.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Fantastic. We will talk about the cyber element of the Russian invasion of Ukraine today. Could you begin by explaining for our audience the concept of cyber conflict and its significance in contemporary discussions on the nature of warfare, and relate that to what our expectations were before the invasion?
Yeah, absolutely. So I would define cyber conflict as a state, right, where entities engage in cyber operations, including offensive, defensive, intelligence gathering activities to achieve strategic, political, and military objectives. And as you can see from this definition, cyber conflict encompasses a range of activities from cyber espionage to sabotage to disruptions of critical infrastructure, as well as the manipulation of information. So as you correctly pointed out, the question, why is this such a big deal in today's world? And I would say that cyber conflict has become so important in the contemporary discussion of the nature of warfare because of its transformative impact on traditional notions of conflict. Unlike conventional warfare, cyber conflict operates in the invisible realm of cyberspace, where attackers can exploit vulnerabilities. They conduct operations with relative anonymity. And this blurring of traditional boundaries between warfare and other forms of statecrafts, along with a diverse range of actors involved, raises a lot of complex challenges related to attribution, deterrence, and accountability. I'm happy to elaborate on any of those if you like eventually. And then going back to your last question, right, what we expected before the invasion from cyber conflict. And I would say there were two main big expectations right before the invasion from cyber operations. On the one hand, we had scholars, policymakers, they were advocating for the complementary use of cyber and conventional military operations. And they were saying that we should see massive employment of offensive cyber capabilities. We did see some of it, but a lot of them, they depicted these cyber doomsday scenario where cyber operations will be used to, you know, blow up buildings, etc. And we don't see those. And on the other side, we had scholars who actually even saying in December of 2021, basically 2 months before the invasion, and the Russia already had troops on the Ukrainian border, saying that we shouldn't see the invasion by military use at all. This is just a bluff. And we should just see more use of cyber operations to achieve sort of the same strategic effect as the war could serve. And obviously, we know this didn't, it's not the case.
Thank you for that. Let me follow up immediately and backtrack a little bit to the effects that cyber conflict could have on some of our traditional or more traditional views of warfare. And I will ask about deterrence and also about attribution. So what are the possible effects of cyber warfare on deterrence? I mean, attribution is something that we've discussed on this podcast before when I interviewed Giro Minier on threat intelligence, but I feel that deterrence and attribution are conceptually linked. Could you elaborate on this, please?
Yeah, absolutely. So basically, when we think about deterrence, like what deterrence means, right? So basically, you try to deter somebody from not doing something, right? So in this case, we would like to potentially deter Russia from invading Ukraine. And so what is difficult in cyberspace, it's not impossible, but it's a bit, you know, requires way more efforts than in a conventional way, is to know who did a particular action, right? In this case, a cyber operation. So for instance, if I'm doing something and I'm saying, hey, you shouldn't do it because there could be all these consequences that can hurt you even more. In cyberspace, I'm not saying, hey, it's me. And it takes time to attribute it technically as possible. But in addition to technical, I mean, it also takes time. It also requires the use of human intelligence, other sources of intelligence to actually attribute it to a particular, actor, because even the attribution to a particular machine doesn't mean that the actor is sitting behind this machine, right? And so that complicates this issue of deterrence, because obviously if you don't know who is doing it, you don't know, like, you know, whether this particular actor sent this message and whether you're reading it correctly. Also, we know that in cyberspace, there are all these false flag operations, right? So what it means is basically somebody is pretending to be somebody else. So for instance, China is pretending to be Russia. For instance, when you track the sort of online activity or the code that has been written, and you were like, oh yeah, this is Russia because there's a bunch of inserted Cyrillic alphabet in the code. But Chinese hackers can do it, right? They can operate during the time, the normal working time in Moscow. And so there's all of this stuff basically blurs and makes it very complex, this notion of sort of, deterrence that we get used to it.
So if we look at the Russian full-scale invasion of Ukraine as a case study, you just discussed how the expectations before were ambiguous about what effect cyber conflict was going to have. What has this conflict taught us about the role that cyber conflict plays in modern warfare, or at least so far?
Yeah, I mean, there are so many lessons. I think it's such a unique, empirical case studies that allows us to observe, unfortunately, the potential effect of cyber operations to its sort of fullest ability. And there are a lot of interesting nuances, but I would say there may be like three main lessons I would highlight. So the first one is that to achieve a kinetic effect, right, one need to use kinetic means. Basically, kinetic means are more preferable than cyber operations, given that war is a fast-moving environment, right? So basically, the cyber doomsday scenarios that I mentioned, they often depicted in Hollywood movies or even, sometimes newspapers, where cyber attacks can blow up building, are not happening in reality. And this is what we have seen in the case of Ukraine. Of course, cyber operations can disrupt, they can damage, and they can be used to achieve those temporary effects. But if the primary objective is the destructions, the military operations are obviously way more effective, given that we are in the situation of war, right? I mean, it's very different when it's peacetime, situation, gray zone, whatever. But if already the troops are on the ground and you need this building not functioning or be disrupted, obviously it's way more effective to do it. And this brings me to, I guess, a second insight from this war. I think it was a surprise to many, especially in the beginning, is that the internet has continued to function throughout the most destructive land war in Ukraine since World War II. And this was not just the persistence of this internet, wasn't just that Russia couldn't, disrupt it, not because of the lack of ability. It's given that Russia has demonstrated its commitment to pour significant resources to other aspects of this war. There has been some instances, anecdotal evidence demonstrated that in many cases, Moscow had made a strategic choice to keep the internet up and running for friendly advantages, right? Including leveraging intelligence gathering capabilities via cyber espionage, conducting information operations, which is basically trying to manipulate public opinion, ensuring continuity of logistics support. Right at the beginning of the war, there was all these examples when the Russian militaries were using Ukrainian internet just, for GPS, right, to find their way in Ukraine, and also facilitating civilian affairs, right? So there are all these benefits of having internet up and running. You can do a lot of interesting activities that are more beneficial in this case. And the last insight that I would like to share is that it relates to the interoperability between cyber and military operations, right? So with cyber operations, in most cases, especially in the case of war, they are not able to achieve strategic effects on their own. And they are often used to complement military operations. And we've seen examples of those from both sides. But what is remains to be a challenge is that it still is very difficult to synchronize the two fronts in real time. To do it effectively still remains a challenge and will remain it for some time, even though various militaries, including the U.S., has been becoming better at this. But it's still not working as smoothly as with other fronts, like, for instance, air and ground operations.
Thank you for that answer. You've touched upon this to a degree just now, and I know you talk about this in your work, and this has already been part of the discourse around cyber conflict. You've talked about the difference between cyber tools used to generate damage, direct damage, and those cyber tools that are being used for information gathering. And the empirical evidence right now seems to be showing that information gathering is actually more important in the cyber domain currently than, you know, attempts to cause direct damage. Would you characterize this statement as correct?
I would say so. I mean, of course, there are like nuances to a particular situation depending on objective, but we know that information is a power, right? Information is power in war, like situations as well. And so given that we are now living in the information age, obviously, who has better, more accurate information potentially can use it to shift the balance of power, right? There's a lot of the not related to this case in Ukraine specifically, but there's all this discussion about China's espionage efforts, right? And whether basically stealing a lot of plans and the information from the U.S. contractor, like, and trying to build similar weapons and systems, whether it could potentially, shift the balance of power in a few decades, saving them time in doing the research on their own, right? So, absolutely, I would say that information is the key. But of course, depending on the situation, sometimes disrupting and damaging the network systems, the object could also be important.
We're now in the third year of the open conflict. Of course, the conflict began in 2014. But I'm interested in the evolution of the cyber conflict in Ukraine. How has the cyber domain in Ukraine evolved since the beginning? And what other patterns are there that we can identify? We have seen some new hacks, the attack on the Ukrainian telecommunications providers, for example. And I was just in Brussels and there was discussion of the continuous onslaught of attacks happening on Ukrainian systems. Are there any fundamental changes in the way this conflict is developing in the cyber domain?
That's a great question. I would love to learn at some other time from you what you have learned in Brussels. But you're right. There has been some sort of fluctuation in learning and adjustment from both sides, right? So before the invasion, we have seen that there have been extensive cyber espionage campaigns against not only Ukraine military and government, but also against NATO. NATO countries as well, various Ukrainian partners. And some of these cyber espionage campaigns, they have been tracked back to 2019, right? So 2019 to January 2022, there was a lot of cyber espionage campaigns and various efforts to obtain as much intelligence as possible about the plans of Ukraine and also its Western allies. And then obviously the first few months of the war, the war phase is called initial invasion. It's usually from February to, I think, April. we've seen a bunch of those disruptive and destructive cyber espionage, cyber campaigns, right? So basically, there was an attack on Viasat, which is a test satellite company on which the Ukrainian military relies on. So the goal was to potentially disrupt some command and control, slow down the response by the Ukrainian military. There was a bunch of malware, wiper malware operations with the goal of, again, to sort of make the information unavailable, destroy some of the information, making sure that Ukrainian government and military are not able to respond in a timely fashion. And basically what was interesting, I was looking at some of the reports from the private sectors that were discussing sort of various trends. And they, I think they mentioned that during the first two or three months of the Russian invasion, they have been more disruptive cyber operations against Ukraine than during the previous 8 years, right? So basically previous 8 years is the since 2014, since the sort of first phase of this war, and then during the actual invasion. I mean, obviously the stakes were much higher, right? But it's an interesting number. And then of course, like over the summer, there has been some slowdown in the cyber operations. And one potential explanation could be, of course, there has been a lot of effort to use the access that they already have, right? Because in order to execute operations, you have to obtain access to the system and network. And so if you have used that, some of those, you have to sort of slow down and obtain new access. So that could be one explanation. But we have seen sort of decline in those. And then there has been, again, sort of rise in the disruptive cyber operations in October, starting, I think, October, basically the fall and the winter after that. And also we have interesting patterns as well that have been like matching the phases of war, right? The evolution of war in the info ops side, right? So basically, as I mentioned, when we talk about cyber conflict, we not only talk about the disruptive cyber operations, the cyber spinners, there's a lot of stuff that's happening meant to influence people. And there have been, again, spikes around, you know, invasion, troop mobilizations in Russia around the buildup, and they were all like addressing different themes. So at the beginning of the war was about like, oh, West is just the source of all the evil, and then slowly changed the themes to appealing to the common Soviet past. And again, you can see that Russia is trying different sort of tactics depending what is working, what is not at different phases. And if the listeners are interested into this sort of question of evolution, I highly recommend this article by Dr. Aaron and Tala Brandy. I'm happy to share the link with you. But basically, they do this analysis where they look at the evolution of Ukrainian conflict starting with 2014 to 2022, and then the last 2 years, right? And they, there's a lot of nuances, right? Not only like what kind of attacks have been used, but what kind of targets, what kind of sectors, what kind of themes. It's super, super interesting stuff. It came out, I think, like a few months ago. And the last question related to your, about the telecom, right? Yeah. So basically, yeah. So this telecom, it was kind of big deal, right? I mean, I think a lot of these attacks have come to light, and it's a big deal in a way that it's Ukraine as a testing ground, right? You know that there was attacks against the power grid in 2015, 2016. It was a big deal because it was just like one of its kind. And then you have Neon-Petya. It was also like important because of its own significance. I think this one is also important because of its significance. However, the strategic impact, since we're talking about it, I wouldn't say that it was, the effect was strategically important. There was a lot of discussion what was done. And so basically, I believe the 24 million people didn't have, right? They were not able to use, you know, internet. They basically rushed to the store, buy the new SIM cards from different providers because it was done against Kyivstar. Also, the timing was awkward, right? It was December 12th. I mean, the president, Zelensky, was in the US, but also it wasn't clear, like, why the particular day it was used. And so there was a lot of discussion about, you know, whether there was done to achieve any strategic value, which again, it didn't, or whether they, you know, Russian hackers, they were just trying to demonstrate their usefulness. So I really like one of the sort of arguments that Gavin Wild posted in his Carnegie report. And again, I'm happy to share the link to this discussion, where he basically says, they need to show their usefulness. Otherwise, the option would be to, you know, take the weapon and join the front, right? Because if you think about sort of the logic of this attack, they had access since May, and they were sitting there until December, and obviously having access and collecting presumably some intelligence and some of this information. It seems to be more useful than to execute this attack that didn't have a very significant strategic impact. But if you do, maybe you're just trying to show somebody who's above you, oh, look, we can do this, and it created all this chaos, right? For me, it seems logical that keeping this access would have been more beneficial.
Yes, thank you. And thank you for the article recommendation. Great. So I want to zoom in on some more specific aspects of the conflict. I'm wondering if you could discuss, A, what are the most common types of attacks that are used? And B, if maybe you could give one or two examples of attacks that are occurring so our audience can have a better real-world idea of what different attacks are actually being implemented.
So yes, I would say when we speak about cyber operations, I would distinguish three main categories, right? So the first one is the cyber disruption or degradation types of the attacks. And so basically those means when you get into the system, you obtain the access to the system and you try to do some damage. Right. So it could be, you know, wiper attacks is one of the examples. So basically you go inside and you kind of destroy all the data. And obviously in such a way you are not, you know, make the work of the company very difficult, right? Could be one of those ransomware, I would say partially could be, I guess, described as those. And those seems to be should be sort of familiar to many because there has been a rise in ransomware attacks over the last few years, or I guess last decade. But the main goal is basically you go inside of the system and you lock the system, right? So if I'm a user, I'm not able to get access to anything unless I pay the ransom. And all this is very scary because especially if it's done on against the hospital, then, you know, it's a life or death situation. It didn't happen in Ukraine, luckily, but we have seen sort of pseudo ransom situation there as well. And then second set of attacks that I mentioned, those are sort of cyber espionage. The difference between those and the former one is that you go in the system and you don't do any damage. You go inside and you just sit in and collect intelligence, collect information, and you send it back. And of course, some of the cyber espionage operations, they turn out to be disruptive because you're just sitting and you're waiting for a good moment and then you execute it, right? So the operation that we discussed, the attack against the telecom company Kyivstar, is one example, right? They were there for, what, 6 months and just sitting, collecting information, and then they disrupted the work of the company, which affected a lot of users. But not all of the cyber operations, cyber espionage operations are meant to actually do the damage, right? A lot of them, they actually useful just for collecting information and can last many, many years. And then the last one is the info ops. As I mentioned, a lot of those are done. The basically the usual way, right? The main goal is to affect public opinion. But given the rise of the social media and accessibility, basically the internet allowed those traditional sort of informational psychological operations, right, to be to reach a different scale. And what is interesting in the case of Ukraine is that we have seen a lot of deepfakes videos. Of course, some of them are, you know, poorly done. One of the infamous ones was the deepfake of the President Zelensky that declared his troops to go back, to basically run away from Russia, to give up, right, during the first few days of the war. And obviously, it was very quickly proven that it's fake. But we do know that some of deepfakes are, I mean, right, amazingly good. And so we have seen sort of info ops reaching a different scale in this war, because it's a use of AI technology in creating images, fake images with fake speeches, obviously, can reach a different, different effect.
Thank you. So I want to turn to Ukraine's international allies. There was a lot of talk at the beginning of the invasion, just before and just after, about help Ukraine received in the cyber domain, not just from state actors, but also from the Western private sector. So how have Western allies and the private sector helped Ukraine in strengthening its cyber defenses?
Absolutely. It's a very, very important component of this war, right? So as you mentioned, yes, before the invasion, I believe it was December, at the end of 2021, I think it's December, maybe it's earlier, UK and the US governments, they send their cyber teams to help Ukraine with its cyber front. And we do know that there has been a lot of activities before the invasion. We do know, right, there have been some instances where these allies and also the corporations, they actually made an effect. Microsoft has published a number of reports in which they actually describe some of the attempts that has been done. So for instance, in April 2022, they stopped the attack against various Ukrainian entities from Strontium. And this is basically actor connected to Russian government, GRU, which is General Staff of Armed Forces. And also there has been cooperation between the French security organization, ANSI, and the U.S. National Security Agency, with collaboration with Ukrainian services. And they also were able to stop sabotage of satellite telecommunications infrastructures. And we do know that U.S. government has been, specifically Cyber Command, has been involved in the hunt forward operations. Basically, what they mean, they fly to the host country. Usually, the country invites and asks for this assistance, and they go on their networks and they look for various threats. In this case, the threats on Ukrainian networks, and they try to help the host company of mitigating them as well. And again, those are just like some small publicly available information. I'm sure there has been a lot of the information that is not sort of publicly available, but we know there has been a lot of efforts. But also what I'd like to mention is that even though we tend to talk a lot about the assistance right before the war and during the war, Ukraine has significantly benefited from the assistance from the companies, but also the Western partners since 2015 in building its cyber capabilities, right? After the first part of this war, after sort of 2014, Ukraine has realized that cyber is becoming an important component of this sort of green zone conflict, or whatever we call it, hybrid, Russia's hybrid warfare, and they seek for the assistance. And there has been so many efforts done to to build the capabilities, right? Not only technical, not only sort of various sort of exchange programs and education training stuff, but also Ukrainian government has been working with these Western partners in developing a variety of sort of legislations, organizations within the government, right? So I think since during that time, they have like, I don't remember how many, but like 8 or 9 new laws. And of course, I mean, some of them more successful, some of them less. There's still a lot of things that Ukraine needs to improve. But I think those sort of 8 years, right, almost 8 years prior to the invasion, when Western partners and companies helped Ukraine to boost the cyber security has been significant, right? And the last 2 years is more like it was a steep learning curve. And I mean, Ukraine has become also so much better from that continuing assistance.
I want to link to what you just said about visibility. I'm curious about to what extent is the cyber conflict in Ukraine actually visible? To what degree is it hidden from view? Cyber operations are easier to conceal than others. It's more akin to intelligence work than kinetic conflict, which is perhaps easier to document. Can we really tell if Ukraine's cyber defenses are effectively limiting Russian cyber offensive operations?
No, absolutely. Yeah, it's always the question is like, has the Russian government, right, even attempted anything, or they're not just attempting anything and we're like, oh, Ukraine is so great, right? But, you know, to answer sort of your first question, how much of this is hidden? Of course, the question depends on the nature of cyber operations. And this is sort of, I touch upon right? So if we talk about the cyber espionage, we should never hear about it, right? If this pure cyber espionage is attempted, if we hear about the attempted cyber espionage, then obviously this is, hasn't been successful. And we have heard about many of those, right? Again, likely a lot of the information about what has been done by the private companies, because the sort of they advertise their services and their capabilities, right, has been published without giving like the actual nuances. But we have heard about many of those attempts that have been detected. Of course, if the goal is to disrupt a particular functionality and the distributed denial of service attack is used, obviously we're going to hear about it because that's the goal, to make it, you know, not functioning, and it's very, very loud. So of course those, you know, so that serves a different purpose. But as I mentioned, a bunch of companies, they published a variety of reports, and they demonstrate how they were able to mitigate some of the attempted attacks. And given this evidence, I would say is that, yes, Ukrainian cyber defenses with corporations from the private sector have effectively mitigated significant amount of Russian cyber offensive capabilities and attempts. But as I said, like, of course, let's say it could be, some would argue it could be the case that Russia is not trying, or Russia is, you know, waiting for the big moment or whatever. But I would say, given the high stakes in this conflict, I mean, it's, yeah, it's every moment, right? We were like, okay, something will happen. But it has been 2 years. The stakes have been extremely high. There has been discussion about the potential use of tactical nuclear weapon. So I would say that it's not unlikely the case that Russia hasn't attempted it. I think they have used as much as they can. I'm not too sure how much of those exploits they're still keeping in their stockpile, but I think they obviously are amending their tactics and strategies. But I would say that, Ukrainian efforts together with the Western partnership has been significant in throwing what Russia has prepared for this war.
Yes, I think I agree with you. But it seems to be a question that comes up regularly. I have two final questions. The first question, and I want to get my terminology correct. What role do non-state actors play in this conflict? Although I think that they're not really non-state actors, they're more state adjacent, right? So we have this volunteering force in Ukraine, the IT Army of Ukraine, and you have, you know, APTs in Russia that are, some are directly part of the state, some are associated with the state. So I'm curious about the role that these various players have on the conflict, although I'm more interested in the volunteering IT Army of Ukraine, and what role does this have on Ukrainian defenses?
Yeah, absolutely. So again, it's the Ukraine case is a, such a unique, provides such a unique opportunity to revise a lot of research questions, but also policy questions, international law and implications. And obviously the involvement of these civilians, right, sort of civilians has been a main an important aspect of this war. And so the IT Army of Ukraine, as you correctly mentioned, it's consists of a number of volunteers, and they actually do offensive and defensive operations. So we've heard of some successes of this group, right? So basically, from the offensive side, at least they try to advertise what they do, because it's a lot of times it's sort of a part of those, you know, hackers to brag about what they have done online. And so we have seen that they hacked the Moscow Stock Exchange, they defaced a bunch of websites. The question, of course, remains unclear for me how much of those efforts have been successful, right? So, of course, we've seen this is what they have done, but I'm not too sure how much of those efforts are translating into sort of significant strategic implications on the what is happening in the war, right? And so, of course, I don't want to diminish the efforts, but it's the clear strategic value or implications for what is happening on the ground or how we change the course of the conflict is not clear for me. We don't hear too much about the defensive efforts on sort of on their front, but you know, it would be interesting to know exactly how exactly they have contributed. You know, what I've heard from some of the public commentaries is that efforts by this IT army also posed some challenges, given, for instance, some volunteers that lack professional training. For instance, when they potentially execute an operations, right? So they disrupt a particular network system, and it could be more beneficial to actually maintain access, right? To continue spying or something like that. So I feel like this has been a lot of those sort of anecdotes when, because you manage a lot of people who don't have necessarily sort of military training, right? Or professional training, and they are sort of, try to figure out and act on the spot. Some of these actions might be hurting the efforts of this IT army than helping them. On the other hand, what is super, super important is that the involvement of civilians in this conflict has raised many questions about sort of cyber warfare ethics. And we know that this question has been there for a decade, right? Because it's been always about discussions about the applicability of the international humanitarian law to the warlike situations, who should be treated as combatants, who should be not, and all of that. But what is important about the civilian efforts in the war in Ukraine is that their actions were able to push this discussion into some sort of concrete recommendations. So particularly last year, the International Committee of the Red Cross, they published rules of engagement of civilian hackers in conflict, and they have a number of those recommendations. And actually the IT Army of Ukraine, they said that they will comply. They will try to do as much to comply with these efforts. So I think, like, again, they are sort of pluses and minuses, but I think we are sort of moving in some directions, and this wars have such a significant impact of our reevaluation of understanding what the role of non-state actors is in cyber conflict.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, there was actually quite a lively panel at a Brussels conference I was attending recently just on this topic, on civilian and private contractors, are they combatants, etc. It was quite interesting.
I mean, it's real, right? It's very, because it's kind of like, it's a blurry line. It's hard to know. It's very hard to figure this stuff out. And I think before the war, I mean, again, as I mentioned, there was a lot of sort of the common assumption, like it's all about cybercrime, right? But now with this war in Ukraine, Syria, you have all these, you know, blurry lines. And especially given that so many companies went to help out so quickly, and we don't think about these implications, but now everybody's hacking everybody. And then the question is like, yeah, let's wait a minute. Can we treat all of them as combatants or not? Right. So yeah, I'm glad that there has been some movement in that regard.
Yeah, the lines are definitely becoming more blurred. So my final question, and this is a hypothetical question and perhaps a bit of a provocative one, but it goes to the heart of our discussion today. The war has shown that there are limits to cyber conflict. But is there a possibility, given the evolving nature of cyber security, cyber offensive operations, that we'll still see attacks that could cause serious kinetic leg damage in the near future?
No, I don't think so, right? I think we have seen that everything that is out there, right? So I don't think the cyber conflict in terms of its tactics, I mean, obviously it's evolving, as you mentioned, but I think it's kind of has evolved. We've seen everything that is out there, right? As I mentioned, the stakes are quiet for a while. And so if Russia were to say something for this future, I would say the future has already occurred. But of course, we would see sort of learning of how cyber tools, right, or cyber options could be used. So I think the recent one, what was sort of relates to this lesson in terms of interoperability that I mentioned at the beginning of our discussion, is that the Russians moved some of their sort of IT people closer to the front line, right, to the front line. So if they capture some of the Ukrainian technology, they can quickly analyze it, they can extract it, and they can, you know, use it for some intelligence and useful stuff. So I think that is an interesting and a very useful development. But in terms of creating the cyber doom scenario, or is again, just like, you know, launching cyber attacks and solving war in Ukraine, it's not gonna happen. But I do believe that cyber will continue playing an important role as a complementary tool in future conflicts and in this conflict as well. And how we use it more quickly to have some concrete changes on the battlefield will be also evolving from, you know, Russian side as well as Ukrainian and Western side as well.
Yes, I think you make a very convincing case for this. It definitely seems that it is a domain where technology is augmenting rather than completely transforming
exactly.
Warfare in the 21st century.
I like augmenting. I'm going to borrow that word from you, augmenting.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you can cite the podcast when you do.
I will.
So, Nadia Kostyuk, thank you so much for appearing on our podcast.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
And that's all for today. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Berlin Security Beat. Please remember to follow the Center for International Security on all our social media channels. If you're interested in a master's in international affairs with a focus on international security, please go look at the Hurdy School. We have a world-class program available. And until next time, this is David Bukowski coming to you from Berlin.